You're listening to Pushing the Envelope, Life at the Cutting Edge of Customs Innovation. I'm Tom Muller with the Cross Border Research Association. On this show, we explore the frontiers of customs creativity in conversations with customs and logistics experts, technology innovators, research scientists, and other leaders in the field. Industry insiders call this show the PennCast because it's part of PennCP, a network for boosting customs innovation funded by the European Union's Horizon 2020 program. Today, I'm speaking with Dragos Tudorache, a member of the European Parliament and Vice President of the Renew Europe Group. Mr. Tudorache was chair of the Special Committee on Artificial Intelligence in the Digital Age until the AI Act was passed last December. He also sits on the European Parliament's Committee on Foreign Affairs, Committee on Civil Liberties, Justice and Home Affairs, the Subcommittee on Security and Defense, and the Delegation for Relations with the United States. Hello, Mr. Tudorache, or Dragos, if I may.
You're very welcome. Happy to be here.
Congratulations, by the way, on getting the AI Act passed. That was a long, complex negotiation that concluded.
Not yet fully passed. It passed the council last week with unanimity, I might add, which is a good news. And we still are left to pass it through Parliament for the final vote, but I don't anticipate any issues there.
Oh, very good. Well, half congratulations and fingers crossed.
Thank you.
When is the final vote?
Well, we're voting in committees because that's the sequence that we have in Parliament on the 13th of February, so basically very soon. And then the final vote, depending on when translations in all languages will be available, which is a bit of an issue because it's a very complex and, as you probably know, a big text. So hopefully we'll be ready with that for the March session, if not at the latest in April.
Wow. Okay, very good. I'll be looking for news on that. That's very exciting. To start off with, could you give our listeners a word about your background and what brought you to the European Parliament?
Oh, right. Well, how far back do I go? I'm a judge by profession. So I started my career as a very young judge in Romania. Spent a few years doing that before I got interested in international career. Then I worked for the OSCE, for the UN in the Western Balkans, for the international justice programs there. And then I moved on to the EU, started first with the European Commission's delegation in Romania before the accession, and then after accession moved to Brussels, worked for more than 12 years in the European Commission, where I led several big projects, mostly in the area of home affairs, but not only. Established an agency, did many other things, and then I was co-opted in government back home in 2015. I served as a head of chancery and minister of interior, then in the European Parliament, and here I am today.
Your background, expertise, and current interests in the European Parliament include artificial intelligence and new technologies, security and defense, internal affairs, transatlantic issues, and the Republic of Moldova. I mean, in various ways, each of these intersects with the topic of innovation in customs and border security, which is the focus both of this podcast and of PennCP, the EU-funded project to which this podcast belongs. So I'd love to explore each of these areas in turn and briefly hear your thoughts. Starting with artificial intelligence and new technologies, you spent, as we said, the last several years working intensively on AI legislation, and in the process have become one of the world's authorities on how artificial intelligence intersects with EU law. What, in your view, are the most important new tools in AI and machine learning that need to be implemented by customs administrations at the borders? And on the flip side, on the dark side, if you will, of customs and borders, what new tools do you expect criminals to be using to try to slip their illicit cargo past borders undetected?
Well, like with everything, AI has the power to optimize almost all processes that we employ right now. It's true, again, for almost every sector of human activity, certainly for every sector of administration, and therefore customs and generally border processes, whether it's border security or processing of merchandise or persons, can certainly benefit from the employment of AI in any of these processes. It can simplify, it can speed up, it can do the sampling on the basis of algorithms that can be created on the basis of risk assessment. Customs is mostly done on the basis of risk assessment checks. So all that was already using at least in the last decade, sophisticated software for any of that, and technology combined with that software. But now I expect that with artificial intelligence, that is going to grow exponentially, both in terms of speed and complexity of the analysis and the risk assessments that are being done. So certainly there is room for use of AI, again, both when it comes to custom checks as well as to border procedures in general. You also mentioned the flip side, which is always present, again, everywhere, and certainly is going to be present here, because criminals are, unfortunately, almost always ahead of the curve, sometimes ahead of the law enforcement authorities when it comes to the adoption of new technologies. They are usually earlier adopters than almost everybody else. So we can certainly anticipate that also them, they will be trying to employ AI to either disguise merchandise or to counterfeit certain processes and procedures and paperwork and flows of documents. So that requires a response on the side of the authorities that will have to counteract, identify, detect, and respond to what would be, from my point of view, an easy to anticipate surge of the use of AI on the side of criminal organizations as well. Mm-hmm. There is also another flip side. You didn't ask it, but I need to put it on the table, which is the flip side of potential negative effects of deployment of artificial intelligence in the border or customs context. Because in a way, we humans do have an automation bias. We do believe that, well, if we employ a machine or algorithm to do something, in theory, it should be better, cleaner, faster. But it's not necessarily always that way, because you always have the possibility of discrimination creeping in, biases creeping in, whether they are existing in the databases that we use to train an algorithm or whether they are engineered, in the sense, even without knowing, those writing codes might have blind spots in terms of effects of the algorithm towards, let's say, the ultimate customer of a process, whether they are companies that are putting their merchandise in the customs process, or whether they are individuals who are part of border procedures. So I get, again, there is a duty of care when it comes to the effects of AI, and make sure that, again, they do not produce negative effects on the subjects of the law.
That's a very, very important flip side dimension. We do tend to think, sometimes tend to think of AI at the borders, especially regarding human movements, as a sort of dystopian big brother. But you're saying that there are sort of implicit biases that can creep in, that we tend to trust machines more than we trust, in a sense, our own conscience.
Absolutely, because ultimately we would be asking algorithms to do what? To do profiling, again, profiling of people, or profiling of containers, or profiling of shipments that might be riskier than others, and therefore they need to be subject to controls or to certain detection, fraud detection mechanisms. And again, when you do that sort of profiling, that sort of anticipation of risk, there is always, again, that flip side. There is always the associated risk of creating discrimination, or checking or sampling some versus others on the basis of elements and variables that may contain biases, prejudices, either in the way, again, society has worked so far, and that is reflected in the data sets that are being used to train the algorithm, or in the way it's been designed by its creators.
It is interesting, though. We tend to think of algorithms as these things that are out there, but they are, in fact, they encode some of our own biases. Human beings are writing those codes and the way they think.
Always. And sorry to add complexities to it, but we are also going to see, in fact, we are already seeing that is part of our reality right now, but that's going to, again, grow even more in the coming years, which is AI algorithms produced by AI algorithms. So we are no longer in a world where only humans produce algorithms. That world is already by now yesterday. Because now many of the very powerful foundation models, many of the large language models, are also capable of writing code themselves. So in the next couple of years, we will have AI producing AI. And therefore, I think the risks for those blind spots increases even further.
This is fascinating. How much training do you have in the technical aspects of AI? You obviously learned a lot along the way, but do you need
Zero.
A coder to legislate on code?
No, I'm a lawyer. I don't have a technical background at all. I barely use my phone. And sadly, I use it less and worse than my kids do. But I grew interested in the topic, mostly in its implications, the more political, strategic implications of artificial intelligence. That's how I decided to focus on this topic during this mandate. And in the process of doing it, I have educated myself to the point of being able to legislate, but I remain a legislator, and my knowledge of AI implies all of its implications rather than the intrinsic workings of an algorithm or how you write it.
In a sense, that could be an advantage, however, if you're looking at it from a human perspective and a humane perspective. I've talked with coders at the Pentagon who don't understand the question of self-targeting killer drones being part of their responsibility. They're like, no, I just write the code. Actually,
exactly. No, I agree with you. I actually think a certain distance from the technology itself and how it works, I think it helps to keep things in perspective without getting that biases. We're speaking of biases, that bias of being too much into it, too much connected to how it actually is being developed, designed, and rolled out. And therefore, you might see it as something that is just a piece of technology. And I hear that argument a lot. It's just a piece of technology. It's just an algorithm. What can it do? What harm can it do? And am I responsible for that harm? No, I mean, I just put it there up on the market. And of course, you can understand where they come from with their argument, but certainly the responsibility that we have as policymakers to think past that, to think at the implications, and then again, put the perspectives in place to come to the right decisions as to how you need to regulate or put guardrails in place to make sure that the technology stays safe.
Well, the AI Act is a magnificent piece of writing and of thinking. And I encourage everyone who's listening to this to pick up a copy, as they say, and read it carefully, because it is one of the key, you know, foundational documents for our future. But thank you for working on that.
Well, subjective, of course, but I do think it's an important piece of legislation that we have produced during this pandemic.
Objectivity is a very elusive goal in this activity, is it not? I'm going to jump over a lot of questions that I had for you, because that was a 15-minute question right there. We could spend an entire podcast on that and not scratch the surface. But can you discuss, perhaps, moving on to security and defense, a few of the examples of how AI is needed to recognize trends, objects, risks, and do better, things that customs and law enforcement already do, while, of course, remaining, as we've said, cautious and fully transparent?
Well, I won't repeat what I said earlier about criminals being always ahead of the game when it comes to technology, but particularly as a lot of our crime has moved online in the last, I would say, even 20 years by now, time flies. And therefore, clearly, the tools to fight either entire criminal activities taking place online to parts of the activities of criminal activities that are taking place online, particularly money trails or financial transactions that are linked or are the consequence of criminal activity. So for all that, law enforcement needs similar tools or even more sophisticated tools to be able to detect or to counteract or to respond to that. And if we don't understand that it is absolutely paramount that we equip our law enforcement with those tools, and if we somehow remain in the logic or the narrative that all tools in the hands of law enforcement can lead to abuses. Yes, they can lead to abuses, which is why you need safeguards in place to make sure that they don't do that. But at the same time, not seeing the need to adopt and to encourage, in fact, law enforcement to also adopt new technologies, in this case, AI, I think is a very short-sighted understanding of what we need to do for our security. Same goes for defense. In a way, the war, not in a way, clearly the war in Ukraine has opened our eyes as to what are the new realities of kinetic warfare. Weapon systems that we all believed were absolutely essential in a war or that had absolutely no response in warfare, reality has proven very differently. And in fact, we now see more and more how even a full-fledged war like the one in Ukraine relies on new technologies much more than we anticipated. And in fact, it seems like we're heading in a new era where defense and warfare is going to be based on attritable weapon systems that are not very expensive in terms of producing them, but that can be very effective in destroying equipments that are worth hundreds of millions of dollars. So what does that mean? That means that because all of these attritable weapon systems, they need a brain, smaller or bigger brain, because most of them are autonomous in their functioning. All sorts of drones, from maritime to air to land drones. And that is, I think, evident by now, that is the future, the direction of travel in terms of the future air defense. And this is where, of course, fundamental questions are popping up. They're already popping up in various war games that are being organized by NATO, either collectively or individually by NATO members. And I'm sure the same is happening in other corners of the world. How far can you go in developing these autonomous brains of attritable weapon system to let them take decisions in the middle of a war? Or even bigger, if you run entire war scenarios on the basis of assessments that are being done by algorithms, what risks come with that? What does that imply? And I've just read yesterday a piece of interesting news. One of the latest such war games that were being planned and rolled out in the US showed how AI that was being asked to develop scenarios all the way to the end in response of hypothetical threats tended to be much more violent in the type of responses that they were proposing, leading all the way to the kind of response that I think any human being would have a very hard time picking as a choice of action. So that shows that, again, over-reliance on technology in the area of defense, particularly when it comes to those final moments when you make decisions, when you make recommendations or decisions that are leading to certain courses of action, that is something that has to be taken with a lot of grain of salt, with a lot of care, because, again, it's certainly not infallible, and also it's certainly not desirable that we work only on the basis of these scenarios. So certainly, again, it's a fact. We have to also, in the area of security and defense, embark in this journey of the digital transformation. That's, I think, beyond doubt now. But how we do that, how we make that integration, keeping always the human in the loop, it's the same principles that we have, for example, in the AI Act, where we say that for certain type of recommendations, decisions, there needs to be always the human in the loop in order to keep that element of safety in those recommendations or decisions that are being made by an algorithm. The same, or even more so, need to stand true in the area of security and defense, employing these technologies.
Wow, that's a sobering scenario. Yes, without the human in the loop, you don't have the safeguard of saying, wait a second, the sanity check, as it were. Is this...
Absolutely.
Yeah. Ooh. Well, moving on to international affairs and transatlantic issues. On foreign affairs, do you see customs policy as a tool to support foreign policy?
Well, of course it is. Maybe it's a bit unseen by the naked eye. You don't automatically or easily think of at customs when you speak of international relations. But I think in the way customs works, in the fluidity of the movement of merchandise, of trade, of across borders, a lot of the and more generally the economic system as we have it at the global stage relies very much on the way customs functions or doesn't. So in a way, a good and well-run customs system in a way adds and helps how the relations between states or blocks are evolving. So yes, there is a link.
And on migration, do you see a closer cooperation between border forces as useful or even necessary? I'm thinking of customs and Frontex cooperation, that sort of thing.
In the international relations or confined to the EU? Because either way, again, it's valid for customs and product. It's certainly valid for people moving, or even more so, because migration has been a phenomenon that has been so much and so prominently part of the debate, societal as well as political debates, pretty much everywhere, not only in Europe, but also in the US. And we see how much it has actually been used to poison society and politics. That number one, certainly it is relevant. So migration is a key political topic, not only inside, not only within a political space such as the EU or in a political space such as the US or in other parts of the world. It is also valid for how international relations and the diplomatic dialogue goes. Solutions that are being adopted for enhancing border security and those agencies that are responsible for it, in our case, Frontex and the national border authorities, are also key. And again, if we only look at the last two political cycles in the EU, starting with 2013, 2014, when the migration, the first wave in what has become almost now a permanent migration crisis in Europe, the issue of border security has always been at the very center of the debate. How to do it? How to enforce it? What kind of extra tools do you need? What kind of extra resources do you need? How much European coordination versus national competences and responsibilities? So all of these are part of a still ongoing, and I don't think that is going to end this debate anytime soon. And as far as we're concerned here in the Union, it's also essential for keeping the Schengen area going. Without safe borders, you can't really have a reliable system of free circulation within the Union. So it's even more of a reason to make the right investments and make sure that that actually works.
And you saw the first migration crisis very up close and personal, didn't you?
I saw it very up close and personal. I was in the heart of it in a way, because I was responsible at the time for the strategy and coordination unit of DG Home Affairs in the Commission. And in fact, we prepared the first responses to the migration crisis. And then I moved on to government, where as Minister of Interior in the Council, we worked on trying to find the right set of answers 2015, 2016 to the migration crisis, and we couldn't. I mean, we found some answers, not all the way as we wanted it, and the files got blocked politically. In fact, only now, after all this time, we in December, we also found a political agreement. Let's see how that passes Council and Parliament on the migration pact, which is meant to finally try and put an end to a very long cycle of trying to amend our migration policies at EU level.
Yes, and in the meantime, the right makes both here on this side of the Atlantic and the other side of the Atlantic, the right makes significant headway and significant ammunition out of this issue, as you say, poisoning the debate in many cases.
Of course, it's a topic that has been politically weaponized, certainly by the extreme right, but not only. Mm-hmm. As a researcher once told me, someone who has researched all migration crises, both in the US and the EU over the last 100 years, his conclusion was that, in fact, the only times when governments made right decisions about migration were when no one was paying attention to migration. In other words, when it was not part of the political debate, because when it is part of the political debate, usually the solutions are not necessarily the wisest.
Wow, amazing. The other is always a threat, a boogeyman that can be used. I need to be respectful of your time, Dragos, so I will jump to closing questions. PanCP, the EU Horizon project that runs this podcast, aims to accelerate technological innovation in customs. Considering your strong involvement in fostering new technologies, how would you suggest customs administration strengthen their collaborative ties with researchers and universities and startup companies?
Well, I think it's essential. Again, because of how omnipresent AI and generally these new technologies are going to be in the years to come, I think anyone that remains behind in adopting and in reaching out towards those that actually hold the keys to a large extent, this technology, again, anyone that does not understand the urgency of that, I think, is going to lose in what is a competition, what is a race. And what is specific to this new, let's call it industrial revolution, is that a lot of the means are not in the hands of the authorities. The data is not in the hands of the authorities. The talent is not in the hands of the authorities. The infrastructure, whether it's the compute power or the networks used or the cloud, almost all of these means are in fact in the hands of private sector or research communities, let's say at large. And I think because of that, public authorities, in this case, customs authorities or border authorities, it's not a matter, it's not a choice or it's a luxury. It's an absolute must that they reach out to the business community, they reach out to the research community, because it is the only way to actually make the right decisions and adopt the right technology, because that's where, again, the talent is, that's where the data is, that's where the technology is.
Mm-hmm. And at the same time, it's in the best interest of these individual private sector players to have a safe border, to have a sound sort of...
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And they stand to gain from public authorities uptaking this technology and integrating it in processes that are also ultimately beneficial to them as well.
Mm-hmm. Well put. Given that PanCP is funded by the EU and given that you also know DG Home policies very well, what is your view of the importance of investing in European research and innovation for security now and in the future?
I think it's crucial that it is being done. I'm happy to see, and in fact, I also participated actively as a shadow rapporteur in the upgrade to the mandate of Europol, for example. I was also part of the scrutiny group for Frontex operations and Frontex evolution. And I think it's key that they remain, not only that they remain open, but they have a proactive strategy in developing their own capabilities, growing their own ability to not only use, but even, why not, develop technologies and solutions of their own, which they need to employ to the benefit of their customers, mm-hmm. whether they are the law enforcement authorities of member states or the border authorities of member states. And the Europol has set up this lab, in which there is funding also from the EU side and also a lot of investment to bring the right expertise in there. And I think it's the way to go.
Mm-hmm. So for you, EU Horizon grants are an important part of the future.
Absolutely.
Last question, if I may ask you, what are your plans for the upcoming elections? Are you running for re-election?
I haven't decided yet. Really? I still have 3 weeks before I make up my mind. I have several options on the table, so therefore I have to decide which one I take. It's I'll think at how I best continue the things that I have done so far, and then I'll make my decision then.
Well, it doesn't surprise me that you have many options, but based on the quality of this conversation, I beg you to stay where you are. Please run for re-election. Thank you so much for joining me. This has been a fascinating conversation. I really appreciate
it. Pleasure. You're very welcome. Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. This has been a conversation with Dragoș Tudorache, member of the European Parliament, who shared his insights on technological evolution and customs and beyond from his viewpoint as a legislator and an expert on AI, security, defense, and more. You've been listening to Pushing the Envelope, Life at the Cutting Edge of Customs Innovation, a podcast that profiles customs leaders and their views, ideas, and inspirations about the future of their field. Join us soon for our next podcast and another insightful conversation with customs trendsetters and forward thinkers. Thank you.